Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book OA Workshop. My name is Violet, and I'm a compulsive overeater and your chairperson today. Today, we are delighted to have both Janet and Melissa continuing to join us from New York. And over the last few hours, they've been sharing their experience, strength, and hope in Overeaters Anonymous, focused on the first four chapters of the AA Big Book. So to open this workshop, let us have a moment of quiet meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer in the plural form. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. And so now, I guess for the final time, I'm going to welcome Janet and Melissa. Good morning, and handing it over to you. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. So we have been talking for 4 hours now about hopelessness and powerlessness, and it's hopeless and we have no power. So I'm going to continue a little more on that, but we didn't want to leave on that note. We wanted to leave with a sneak preview of power and how we start getting it. So I'm going to start on the very bottom of page 43. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So again, it tells me I have a broken bridge, no connection between my memories and my conscious mind, no mental defense. I can't provide it, nor can any other human being. So there goes the group as a higher power, because groups are made up of human beings. Defense must come from a higher power, capital H, capital P. So we will turn the page and start on We Agnostics. And I'm going to do some reading here and then kind of unpack it a little bit. So it says, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. Well, what have we learned, right? That we have an illness over which we're powerless and that it's hopeless. Without divine intervention, it's hopeless. And it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. So wanting to stop, but being able to, is what defines an addict. It's not like, well, if you honestly wanted to stop, you could, which is what people said to me my first few years. But no. An addict is someone who honestly wants to stop, but can't. And then what do they say? Okay, well, if you are an addict, you may be suffering from an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. We talked before about what a spiritual experience is. Basically, in a sentence, it's just God rewiring our hearts to make us less selfish, less concerned about ourselves, and more concerned with him and his priorities, making us, our hearts, more like our creator's hearts. But why will only a spiritual experience conquer? Why is that the only solution? Because this is a spiritual malady and it requires a spiritual solution. If I broke my leg, a physical problem, I don't need psychotherapy. That's a solution to a mental or an emotional problem. At its basis, this is a spiritual problem and requires a spiritual solution. And it says, I love the way they put it, to one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, spiritual experience seems impossible. So it seems like they're saying, okay, you may feel like you're an atheist or agnostic, but deep down, you're really not. And we'll get to that later, how they know that deep down, we're really not. They tell us, okay, we have to find a spiritual basis of life. And a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life isn't sufficient to overcome it. Think about like a code of morals or a philosophy of life, like the Ten Commandments. I couldn't live up to it. Any religion, because I was always trying to do it by my power. And it says these, I'm on the top of page 45, these codes and philosophies didn't save us. Remember, I need to be rescued. I need to be saved, no matter how much we tried. If I'm really drowning, it doesn't matter how hard I try. I need someone to throw me a life preserver. And then it tells me my problem. If we're ever going to try and solve a problem, we need to define it, right? It's like, I don't go to a doctor and say, I'm sick. Guess what? You know, I need to define the problem. If my problem is pneumonia, then my solution is penicillin. If my problem is a broken leg, my solution is a cast. So here they're telling me, you know, kind of the problem. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. So that's our problem. Not lack of desire, not lack of knowledge, not lack of a good moral code. Lack of power, that's my problem. And then it tells me what the solution is. So we have to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be power greater than ourselves, obviously. Well, if I've got this illness and I don't have power over it, then really I'm like an army of one trying to fight an army of 100, the illness. So I need power that's at least 101. Luckily, God is like 100 in a bazillion. So it says, okay, but where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. So the purpose of this book is to help me find power with a capital P. Its main object, numero uno purpose, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Okay, so let's play detective here. If we're atheists or agnostics, and we're saying, okay, I'm open-minded, maybe there's a power, here's a clue. If this power is going to solve my problem, this tells me three things about this power. First, it's got to be smart, because I certainly couldn't figure out how to solve this problem. So this power has to be smart. If this power can solve my problem, it has to be strong, right? At least 101 units of power. So smart, strong. And if he's really going to solve my problem, this power must care about me. Otherwise, might know how, but why would he bother? So smart, strong, and cares about me. That's a God who gets my interest. So those are our first clues. Then it goes on to tell us things that block us, the prejudices that we have that block us. It says, so I'm at the bottom of 45, and it says, we've shared his honest doubt and prejudice. Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. So that's a prejudice, a childhood idea that doesn't work. Perhaps we rejected this conception because it seemed inadequate and thought we abandoned the God idea entirely. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was weak, even cowardly. So that's another prejudice. If I believe in God, that makes me a weak person. Then another prejudice coming. We looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. Remember, that was Bill Wilson's problem. He said, look at all this war and chicanery, and if there's a devil, he seems to be the boss. So we might look and say, okay, if there was a God, why would he allow, and it might be something big like human trafficking, or something personal to us, like a relative to die of cancer. So that might be a prejudice we have, that if I were God, I wouldn't allow those things. I can't understand that. The next prejudice, we looked askance at many individuals who claim to be godly. You know, people will think of like that one nun with a ruler when they were a kid in Catholic school and say, oh, there was one nun and she was a representative of a religious establishment. Therefore, not only all nuns, but all religious people or anyone who believes in God is a bad person. So that's another prejudice. And another one that we can often have is not really a prejudice, but it's something that gets in the way. If I believe in God, I can't do what I want. If I believe in God, I can't do what I want. So it's our job to look at these prejudices and see what's blocking us, what's getting in the way. And it tells us then, okay, you may be enchanted by a starlit night. You know what? Looking up at the stars and saying that's beautiful, it doesn't make us spiritual and it doesn't help us recover. It just shows that there's something inside of us that was put there by our creator that's drawn to things like that. But that alone isn't enough. And then they tell us what we need to do. As soon as we're able to lay aside prejudice, so we have to look at our prejudices and be willing to say, you know what? I don't understand why God allows human trafficking, but I'm just going to assume that he's smarter than I am, and I'm just going to put it aside right now. And maybe just because that nun with the ruler wasn't very nice, it doesn't mean that anyone who believes in God isn't very nice. We have to lay aside our prejudice and express a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves. And someone asked me before, and I said, willingness could look like this. God, I don't know if you're there. And if you're there, I don't know if you care about me. But if you're there and if you care, I need some help. Please help me to find you. Because that's an honest prayer. God doesn't work with dishonesty. We don't want to say, oh, yes, God, I love you. I love you. When we really say, God, I don't know if you exist. And if you do exist, I'm not sure you're not standing there with a baseball bat ready to get me 5 seconds after I die. Always honesty, guys. If we're not honest, it's as if we take a big black magic marker and write, keep out God across our hearts. We shouldn't even bother praying if we're dishonest. We may as well watch Netflix because God's not listening. Honest and honest prayers. And it says, as soon as we lay aside prejudice and express a willingness, we commence to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God, not group, not light bulb or doorknob, God. What are the results we get? And in the next paragraph, they tell us, and I think this is the coolest thing. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. So as soon as we said, okay, God, maybe you're there and maybe you can help me, we get power. We get just enough power, I believe, to move us on to the next step. Remember, provided we took other simple steps, power and direction. So when people would say to me, okay, you admit you're powerless over food, now stick to a food plan. They were asking me to do something impossible because I didn't have power. Power doesn't come in until we start believing that God can restore us to sanity. And then it's like we get a pick line to our heart of power and direction. And there's a promise. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive. It is open, we believe, to all men. It's open to all of us. So they tell us we can have our own conception of God. We just need to ferret out the prejudices. And it says on page 47, we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? So I can be willing to believe. I can make a power. I can make a decision. Remember at the beginning of chapter 5, it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. We can decide that maybe there's a God and be willing for him to show it. For me, he showed it because as soon as I said, God, I admit I'm wrong and I'll just let you show me what you're like. It was like a hand reached in and yanked out the obsession. I believe that God's just waiting for us to come to him. So all we have to do is be willing. And then we have to start practicing spiritual principles. It says on the bottom of page 47, that was great news to us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith. So this book, remember, has two twin themes. Faith without works is dead. Faith is the belief in God, or the willingness to believe. And then the works is starting the spiritual principles. So as soon as we come around, we can start being honest. We don't have to wait until we're at a specific step to get honest. We get honest. We start doing things for other people that are a sacrifice for us. We start cleaning up our past, but right away we start being honest, unselfish. We do what we know. We just do the things that we know. When we turn the page to 48, it tells us some more things that handicap us. Obstinacy, which I looked up, it's a stubborn refusal to change our opinion. Sensitiveness, that, oh, no one can tell me anything, or I just get all bristly. And again, unreasoning prejudice. And it says, this sort of thinking, where we bristle, has to be abandoned. But it tells us that this illness beats us into a state of reasonableness. So usually by the time a person has taken a first step, they're willing to be open-minded. If a person isn't, then I would go back and see, do they really have a solid first step, or they're willing to go to any length? And then they do that whole talk about electricity and prosaic steel girders. We are not going to talk about that. All I will say is I use electricity and I don't have the faintest clue about how it works. I just know I turn on a switch and there's light. And we do that with all sorts of things. And yet when it comes to God, we all need to, you know, be Bible scholars before we say that we'll believe. No, we don't. We turn on the switch. That's the equivalent of we do what we know. And it tells us on page 49 what our purpose is. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. Isn't that great? That, like, I have a role. I used to say, and I'm sure a lot of us did, what's my purpose? Why am I here? Just feeling kind of adrift without a purpose. I do have a purpose. We do have a purpose. We are intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. We are part of God's plan. And I believe that because God launches search and rescue missions, who better to include as his spearhead is people who've been sought after and rescued themselves. And again, they beg us to lay aside prejudice. Again, it's all throughout this book, to lay it aside. And I'm going to flip to page 50. And it says, okay, on one proposition, all the founders of AA agreed on. Now you try and get like two addicts to agree on anything. Now they're saying, okay, 100 agreed. This is what they agreed on. Every one of them has, one, gained access to, and two, believes in a power greater than himself. This power has, in each case, 100% of the time, accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. So I would say at this point, if you have a sponsee you want to give an assignment to, or you want to give yourself an assignment, look at the prejudices you have. And then look at the three traits about God that we talked about. He's smart, he's strong, he cares about us. Do you believe it? If not, why not? Okay, so again, it's not, so we have no excuse to say, well, I can't just make myself believe it. We can. We can. And I'll tell you why. On page 53, is it 53? 55. I may come back, but I think this is just one of the most incredible paragraphs. On page 55, it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. Wait a second. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So that means when God created me, he gave me two eyes, two ears, one nose, one mouth, and the fundamental idea of himself. That's how much he loves me. That when he created me, he wanted me to find him. He wanted me to crave him and yearn for him. So he put the idea of himself in me. But it's obscured. What obscures it? Calamity. Maybe bad things that have happened in my life or that I see going on in the world. And then I say, no, that just blocks me from believing in God. By pomp. Well, that's putting myself on the throne instead of putting God on the throne. I want everything to go my way. And by worship of other things. So what are the other things we worship? Talks about that the page prior. People, sentiment, things, money, ourselves. Who of us hasn't put a boyfriend, a husband, a parent on the throne? Or what I've been guilty of so many times, my kids. If only my kids would do well, my life would be great. That's making an idol. Anytime where we say, the thing that will make me happy, the thing that I can't be happy without is fill in the blank. We've got something ahead of God. We've got an idol. My kids' happiness as an idol. People have whether I'll get married, whether I'll get a boyfriend, whether I'll have a child, whether I'll succeed in my career. These are all idols. Whether I'll have enough money, whether I'll have enough stuff. But deep down is the fundamental idea of God. So we need to see what's blocking it. Because when we do, we get miraculous demonstrations of this power. And it tells us, okay, sometimes we have to search fearlessly, right? We have to look hard. We have to ask hard questions. But he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within, because that's where God put this knowledge. And it tells us, okay, our job, we can only clear the ground a bit. We're seekers. We clear the ground for other seekers. And what do we have to do? Sweep aside prejudice. Remember, our false concept of God can actually get in the way of our relationship with the real God. So what do we do about that? Well, there's someone once who said her concept of God was she just couldn't get past it, of, you know, the kind of God who's up there with a book, writing down the good deeds on one page, the bad deeds on another page. And if when she died, the bad outweighed the good, you know, he was waiting for her with a baseball bat. So what do? We have to sweep aside prejudice. We can recognize that's a prejudice. So here's one thing that we can do. We can do a visualization, and we can just close our eyes and picture that false God with his ledger and his baseball bat standing there. And then we can picture the real God with a face full of love coming in and kicking out that false God. And we can do that, and we can keep doing those kinds of visualizations until they become real for us. That's using our imagination. That's using our brains properly. You know, the proper use of the will. Nope. Remember, God kicked out that false conception. And you can even picture that false God who, you know, with the ledger and the bat, the real God unmasking him. You know, like, The Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain, and just seeing, no, there's no God. It's just some imaginary thing with a God mask on. So we really have to work at getting rid of these prejudices. And while we're doing it, practicing what we know. We know God wants us to be honest. We know God wants us to help other people. We have to do that. And then turn to my favorite story on page 56, the story of the minister's son. So I'll go through this. And then his actual story is called Our Southern Friend. And it starts on page 210, I believe, 208. So here we have the minister's son. And they talk about his story because they think it's like a perfect example. So they say he became rebellious. So right away we see pride. He said there's too much religious education. He was turning his back on God. A lot of things in his family, business failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide, calamity. So he had calamity. And these things embittered him. So he had resentment. So turned his back on God, pride, calamity, and resentment. Well, that's a soil ripe for the illness to move into, and move in it did. So our friend, the minister's son, is in a hospital. He's in a mental hospital. And he's not a happy camper. He says, well, if there is a God, he hasn't done anything for me. And he's just mad, but he's beat. So he says, well, I'll do anything. He's got this willingness to do the work, and he becomes open-minded because later he says, is it possible all the religious people I've known are wrong? So he's got some humility there. Then he has a conversation with a fellow inmate in the asylum. And I'm going to read it just because it's really, I think it's really helpful. So he first goes to the man, his fellow inmate, and just, he says, I'll do anything. Then he goes back. He hears a voice in his head. Remember, he's willing. He says, is it possible all the religious people I've known are wrong? He's got a little humility. And Herb Kay has said, willingness opens the door to grace. So God gives him grace. He hears a voice. Who are you to say there is no God? Well, this shakes him up quite a bit. So he goes back to his friend and he says, I must ask you a question. How does prayer fit into this thing? Well, answers his fellow inmate, you've probably tried praying like I have. When you've been in a jam, you said, God, please do this or that. And if it turned out your way, that was the last of it. And if it didn't, you said, there isn't any God, or he doesn't do anything for me. Is that right? Yes, I reply. And P.S., as an aside, right? Isn't that how I prayed, how we prayed? God, help me. God, help me. God, help me. God, get me out of this mess. God, get me out of this mess. That isn't the way, the fellow inmate continued. The thing I do is to say, God, here I am, and here are all my troubles. I've made a mess of things and can't do anything about it. You take me and all my troubles and do anything you want with me. Does that answer your question? Yes, it does, the minister's son replies. He returns to bed. It doesn't make sense. Suddenly, he says, I feel a wave of utter hopelessness sweep over me. I am in the bottom of hell. And there, a tremendous hope is born. It might be true. I tumble out of bed to my knees. I know not what I say, but slowly a great peace comes to me. I feel lifted up. I believe in God. I crawl back into bed and sleep like a child. In the story, We Agnostics, he just says he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. The barriers he built through the years were just swept away. God didn't say, you know what? You built up all these barriers. You get rid of them yourself. God loves us so much that he's got his spiritual broom and mop, and he comes to help us clean up our messes. That's how much he wants to get close to us. And then he says, this is the minister's son. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore, broken bridge in his mind. Now there was a new bridge, a bridge to God. For the first time, but not the last, he lived in conscious companionship with his creator. He says, thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place, the cornerstone, the chief stone upon which everything else rests. The God of love cares about me. That's it. That's the cornerstone. No later vicissitude has shaken it. I don't know what vicissitude means. I'm assuming it means something like problems. So no later problems have shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away, removed. He didn't remove it. God just took it. That very night, years ago, it disappeared, save for a few brief moments of temptation. And in his story, he talks about the moment of temptation. And you know what he did when he was tempted? He was going to go drink. And then he said, you know what? Let me go tell someone first. And he went and he told his wife. And as he was telling, the obsession went away. See, we get sanity. We start knowing what actions to take. He stopped being dishonest. He says, save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up. He couldn't drink even if he wanted to. God had restored his sanity. And then, what a great line. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Okay, so they're telling me a miracle. Great, I get it. Yet its elements are simple. So they are giving me a recipe. Just like I might get a recipe on, I don't know, how to bake bread, right? You know, you add yeast, you let it rise, you add water, what salt. I've never baked bread in my life. I have no idea. But I'm just saying that's probably what a recipe would look like, step-by-step directions. And they're saying, okay, guys, we're going to give you a recipe for a miracle. And not only that, they say its elements are simple. Okay. And then they tell me what they are. Circumstances made him willing to believe. Step one, circumstances. He saw he was beat. He was willing to believe. Step two, he humbly offered himself to his maker. God, take me in all my troubles and I'll do your will as best I can. Then he knew. So we see that we're beat, we become willing, open-minded, then we offer ourselves to God as best we can. Then he knew. And then it continues, it gets even better. Even so has God restored us all, 100%, has restored us all to our right minds. Remember, it says in the next chapter, once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. He restores us spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly. I think most of us do. But he has come to all, again, 100%, who have honestly sought him. You know, it kind of reminds me when my kids were younger, we used to play hide and seek. And, you know, one time my husband was hiding behind the couch and my son's like, oh, dad's hiding in a tricky, he said in a turkey spot. He meant a tricky spot. Dad's hiding in a tricky spot. God doesn't do that. He wants us to seek him, but he never hides in a turkey spot. He never hides in a tricky spot. He wants us to seek, but he's there. He has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. That is the promise that we want to leave you with. Melissa and I, you know, we talk a lot. When we talk, we just say, God's in the search and rescue business. I personally believe he created the world in 6 days, took a day off to rest, and is now spending the rest of eternity launching search and rescue missions for us addicts. On page 153, it says, the age of miracles is still with us. And it is true. We have seen it over and over and over that when people work these steps, God removes the obsession. And then the person goes on to help other people build their bridges to God. this program still works and the Age of Miracles is still with us. So something that I found helpful for people, and it's generally at the beginning of step three to check on belief in God, is the ABCs on page 60. So it starts A, do we believe, you know, and I ask the person, do you believe you're a compulsive eater and cannot manage your own life? Well, generally that's yes. B, do you believe that no human power could have relieved your compulsive eating? Generally, that's yes. Now, C. C is a multi-part question. And so it's really important we break it down to because then we could see what we really believe. So that God could and would if he were sought. So the first question would be, do you believe that God could, that God can restore people in general to sanity? Not you, but people in general. And usually the person says, yes, because they've seen it in other people. And like, okay, yes, they've seen it. Okay, then, do you believe that God could restore you personally to sanity if he wanted to? Now, he may not want to, but if he did want to, could he? Now, if a person says no, they quickly realize that doesn't make sense, that God could do it for every other person on the planet, but his hands are tied when it comes to them. So generally they say, well, yeah, he could if he wanted to, but I don't think he wants to for me. And that's usually what the hangup is. So then we have an answer for that. So first it's could and would if he were sought. So then it's like, okay, what does it mean to seek him? And I would ask the person to make a list. It means I'm committed to being honest. You know, let's get the boogeyman out of the closet. It means I'm agreeing to spend time with him every day. It means, whatever their definition of seeking them. And if it makes sense, it's like, okay, are you committed to doing these things? And if they say no, then it's like, okay, you're right. God could restore you to sanity if he wanted to, but he won't because you're not willing to go to any lengths. And those are the terms, right? It's like if a helicopter is going to come rescue me from a flood and I say, yeah, no, I'm not going to climb up to the roof. You need to come to my front door. I'm going to drown. But if a person says, yes, okay, I'm willing to do all that, but I still don't believe he will for me, then we have to find out why. And it's usually one of a couple reasons. So the first is a very specific reason. I've done this really bad thing and I don't deserve it. And then we just tell the person, well, that's why there's a ninth step, because we have a chance to make amends, because every single person who came around has done, you know, at least a few really bad things. So sometimes that helps. Sometimes it's a vague sense of I'm not worthy. A person will say, I'm not worthy. And, you know, probably a psychologist might say to them, oh, yes, you are. You just, you know, da, da, da. And I'll say to them, you're right, you're not. But neither was I, neither am I, and neither is anyone else. Worthiness is not a requirement. Not a requirement. Willing to go to any lengths is a requirement. It doesn't say if you want what we have and you're a worthy person with healthy self-esteem, then you're ready to take certain steps. We all have crappy self-esteem. Worthiness doesn't matter. The third reason that someone might have is I've tried this so many times and it hasn't worked. And what I do then is I hold up my cell phone and I say, you know, if for 7 years I try to take a picture by pushing the on button, it's not going to work. But then if my teenage son says, Mom, you're pushing the on button, the camera button's the one under it, suddenly I'm able to take a picture. Now, some people may know where the camera button is on the first day. Some people aren't told or aren't willing to push the right camera button. So if we think God can for other people, we have to believe he can for us. Otherwise, it's dishonest thinking. So then we have to look. Is it because we've done something bad? Well, we get a chance to fix it. Is it because we have this vague feeling of unworthiness? That's not a requirement. Think about it. If I go to a doctor with a broken leg, does he say, you know what, you're really not worthy. I'm not going to set your leg. It's not a requirement. The doctor cares, do I have insurance so I can pay him? Right? He wants, it's transactional. God, I can't hand God a $50 bill or an insurance card. I can hand God my prayers. That's the currency in the spiritual world. To get things done in the spiritual world is prayer. Okay? So saying that I've done something bad, we got rid of that one, right? Because we know we'll get a chance to fix it. And if that was a criteria, there would be no ninth step because only perfect people would be allowed. If it was being worthy, that would be a requirement to work the steps, and it's not. Only willingness is. And if it's I've been trying this for so long and it hasn't worked, we've been pushing the on button instead of the camera button. So I find that generally, if you go through the ABCs with someone like that, they'll come out of it okay. And with that, I pass.